Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Eugene Drucker, whose first novel is The Savior. Eugene Drucker is a violinist with the Emerson String Quartet, teaches at Stony Brook University in New York, graduate of Columbia, former concertmaster of the Juilliard Orchestra. The Savior is about music and the power of music, takes place during World War II, mostly in a concentration camp, featuring a character who is a violinist who did not leave Germany and is conflicted about his feelings at that particular time. This book grew out of two different areas. One is the power of music itself, and from your own experiences back in the 70s, that correct? And mm-hmm. The other is your father's experience. So let's tackle the first. In 1976, you played at various hospitals to get practice in front of audiences, mm-hmm. and you noticed certain reactions, and you thought about a book. Why did it take you 30 years to put that into writing?
First of all, I haven't been working on it steadily for 30 years. Well, I've been so busy with my career as a member of the Emerson Quartet and some of the solo work that I do. I can remember one period of about 8 years where I wasn't working on it at all, and then maybe another period of 4 years or so. And then even when I thought I was working on it, it's not with the same kind of consistency and intensity that a full-time writer would bring to a project like this. I also did try to write some other things in the meantime. I had one other novel I was trying to write and a number of short stories. In addition to that, I was writing nonfiction about music, program notes, liner notes, some articles for various music magazines. The other thing I want to mention is that it took me a while to learn how to write fiction, you know, to acquire some kind of a fictional voice that was appropriate for this character and this story.
But the original idea began back then. At that point, did you conceive the idea of it being in World War II, or did that come later?
Very quickly, I placed it in a concentration camp setting.
And at what point did you realize you wanted to bring in your father's experience? Was that at that point, too?
No, that came later. What I can't remember now is whether any of that material came into my mind before my father's death in 1993. I think probably not. I think most of it I added after he died. What it involved was some flashbacks with these subplots concerning transformations of experiences that my father had in Germany between 1933 and 36.
Did you do any other research?
I read widely about the Holocaust and the whole question of what led up to the advent of Nazism in German history was something that fascinated me from an early age. I took a European history course while I was at Columbia. For one of my courses, I'm not sure which now, looking back on it, I did a term paper on Stefan George, the poet who was offered a very high position by the Nazis. I think it was president of the Reich's Poetry Chamber, and he refused it in 1933. He moved to Zurich at that point. What I was trying to find in George's poetry was whether there was a link, even in the artistic output of a man who was definitely anti-Nazi, to something that would one could locate in the German character that might have led up to this phenomenon.
I noticed in the material I received that you were trying to look at an ordinary person and how that person who was not an activist but not a Nazi would deal with it. In other words, putting yourself or anyone in that position.
Exactly.
The main character, Keller, he's fictional. However, mm-hmm. his friend Ernst is your father.
That's right. My father tried to emigrate to London in 1934. What happened was that he was turned back by the British immigration authorities because he was claiming to come in as a tourist. They were going to give him a tourist visa, but they searched his cabin on the ship and found all sorts of letters of recommendation to various musicians in London. They realized he was there to stay, so they sent him back. My father stayed with the rest of his family until September 1938. It took several years to get the proper affidavits to be able to emigrate to the United States.
It's horrifying now when we think about how easy it would have been for people outside Germany to let the Jews in knowing what was going on. And it was, I mean, yeah. the anti-Semitism of the Nazis was pretty clear.
There were quota systems, I think, in most of the major countries that could have served as safe havens. And the United States, I think, had its own much subtler form of anti-Semitism, especially when it came to foreign Jews coming in that seemed to threaten some people's conception of what the United States should be. So there were instructions sent out to various consuls in different cities in Europe to be very strict in their standards, their criteria. I don't know what they were exactly. The specific intent was to limit the number of Jews who could come into the United States.
So despite your father's status as concertmaster of the Jewish Kulturbund Orchestra in Frankfurt and Vienna, he still couldn't get out.
Until later, two of my uncles made several Atlantic crossings as stokers on ocean liners in order to make contact with distant relatives they had in New York who were helping them prepare the proper affidavits. I think one of the concerns of the government was that some of these refugees would be indigent and then it would be the government's responsibility to support them. They wanted to make sure that there was a network of financial support for people to come in.
Eugene Drucker, how far back does musicianship go in your family? Is it just started with your father?
Yes.
He came to America and got himself settled in. Did he have any problem finding work once he got here?
No, he found work very quickly. Within the first 5 years, he played in the Indianapolis Symphony, one season with the Cleveland Orchestra, with the NBC Symphony under Toscanini for at least one season. Then at the end of the war, he was in a famous string quartet for 2 years, the Busch Quartet, with Adolf Busch, who was a staunch anti-Nazi from the beginning of the Third Reich, and played in the Busch Chamber Players. And in 1947, he joined the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra, where he played until his retirement in 84.
Did he ever tell any stories about Toscanini?
Yes, he told me, first of all, that Toscanini's eyes seemed to be focused on every individual member of the orchestra at all times. I think every orchestra member had that feeling that he was being seen through almost by those powerful magnetic eyes that Toscanini had. And, of course, he told me about Toscanini throwing the baton at somebody or other during a rehearsal. That's something that happened fairly frequently, I think.
The Savior also features a woman named Marietta who comes originally as a refugee from Romania mm-hmm. and eventually emigrates, we think, to Palestine. We don't know the details.
Yes.
Is that based on anybody?
Yes. My father had a girlfriend named Marietta. I think they were together for about a year or so. And she was somehow connected to the Kulturbund. I don't know the exact connection. And she was not a musician. I believe she was somehow in the theatrical division of the Kulturbund. She was planning to emigrate to Palestine with the rest of her family and expected my father to join her, within a year or so. My father did get a job with the Palestine Orchestra that was being formed by Toscanini and the Polish violinist Bronislaw Huberman. And that orchestra eventually became the Israel Philharmonic. My father was always very much a family man, and since the rest of his large family was making these plans to emigrate to the United States, at some point he changed his mind. I imagine he probably wrote Marietta a letter, she having emigrated already to Palestine, and came to the U.S. where he met my mother a few months later. In the late 1980s, Marietta started writing to my father from Israel. My father kept up this correspondence for a couple of years, and then he became too ill with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, to be able to continue corresponding. But I took over the correspondence a little bit, and eventually, on my only trip to Israel in 1996, I met her. And it was an uncanny feeling meeting this woman with whom my father had been involved 60 years earlier, thinking that if fate had taken a different turn, if my father had made a different decision, in a sense, she could have been my mother, except then I wouldn't have been me.
Eugene Drucker, let's talk a little bit more about the Savior. Music, of course, plays a big role, and you've been quoted saying, "I was interested in explaining the dynamic between a performer and an audience, pushed to an absolute extreme." So there is a lot of that dynamic between the audience and the performer, Keller. When you're up there with the quartet or performing solo, mm-hmm. how aware are you of the audience?
Well, I tend to filter out a fair amount of distraction while I'm playing. I sometimes find out from my colleagues in the quartet afterwards that somebody was making noise or that some commotion was happening, and I might be only marginally aware of it, if that. I think I trained myself to some extent to do this, perhaps during these preparatory concerts I played in hospitals where a lot of distracting things did occur. And then in a transformed way, I managed to put them in the introductory scenes of my novel. But I think it's partly involuntary. It's not that I say, okay, I'm going to ignore everything that's going on out there. It's just the particular mode of concentration that I have. That said, there are sometimes events that will impinge on my consciousness while I'm playing. There was a woman who had some kind of seizure in Lincoln Center about 20 years ago when we were playing there. And in fact, just last year, we were finishing a cycle of all the Beethoven quartets at a wonderful hotel in the Black Forest where we've made many appearances. And a woman was taken ill The air was very close in there, and I guess she didn't have enough oxygen. She fainted. There was this big commotion going on, and then she was carried out. We were just standing there, and I remember feeling very upset because we had to go on and play the next piece on the program, and I saw that outside when we went in and out. You see, we didn't have a real backstage area there. We right. went out to the lobby of the hotel and saw about six people hovering over her and one person trying to do some kind of first aid on her, and they were waiting for an ambulance to come. I felt very upset because it appeared to me maybe she's not going to make it. Afterwards, I found out that she was okay, and I was very relieved. These things happen from time to time, and if you have any sense that it might be a serious health problem, something that could even lead to the person's death, well, if you're playing music with any depth to it, somehow it makes a strange connection to the music, because a lot of this music is about some of the deepest issues that human beings have to face, life and death. So how do you make that connection? How do you steel yourself inwardly to go on with a performance if you see somebody suffering like that?
Is it easier or harder, do you think, when you're playing solo or with a quartet to keep those distractions aside?
Well, I don't play solo as often as I play with the quartet nowadays. I used to play solo more. I think that when I play solo, I'm often playing without using the music, so my eyes may be closed. If I'm playing with the quartet, I'm not facing the audience as directly. I'm more at right angles to the audience, but my eyes are open, and I'm looking at the music. I'm looking around also at my colleagues for various cues.
Sure.
So in my peripheral vision, there may be more of an awareness of something happening in the audience if it's within the first few rows.
So that's why when Keller is playing toward the end the Bach Partita, his eyes are closed. He has no idea what's going, and all you can do is write two or three paragraphs about it because he's cut off from the audience at that
right.
point.
Right. Yeah, I tried to write the whole novel from his point of view, even though it's in the third person.
There is a long segment involving the St. Matthew's Passion, this kind of dance that Judas does and what it means. What made you decide to bring that particular discussion or argument into the book?
I myself had played St. Matthew Passion three times when I was in my 20s and absolutely felt overwhelmed by the experience. It's such a great piece of music, such a great musical and spiritual vision, so that even I, as a Jew and a secular one at that, could feel drawn into the spiritual orbit of Bach and his congregation for which this music was intended. So I had played concertmaster of the second orchestra. There are two orchestras in St. Matthew Passion. The violin solo that every violinist wants a chance to play is played by the first concertmaster. It's the famous Erbarme Dich aria, Have Pity on Me, which an alto sings, and has this gorgeous violin obbligato. I don't know if you ever saw Pasolini's Passion According to St. Matthew.
Long time ago,
but that aria is recycled constantly during that movie, and it's very moving, deep music. The aria that I played is a cheerful, bouncy aria, and it's about Judas having approached the high priests after the betrayal of Christ, asking to give them back the 30 silver pieces. He wants Jesus to be released. They refuse to take the silver coins because they say this is blood money and it's against our taboos to have blood money in the temple treasury. So Judas cast down the 30 silver coins. What Bach does in this aria is some fairly simple tone painting. He depicts the sounds of the coins bouncing on the temple floor with a series of rapid scales that the violinist plays before the bass voice comes in and sings this very strong and rhythmic aria saying, "Give me back my Jesus." In the back of my mind for a couple of decades, the question must have been percolating, why would Bach, who had such expressive power and range, have written a relatively cheerful aria about this man who's in the blackest despair? And I had never really tried to figure it out, but somehow in the course of writing this book and trying to flesh out a conversation between Keller, the protagonist, and a music-loving guard whom he meets named Rudy, it occurred to me this was the way in, not only to understanding this phenomenon in the St. Matthew Passion, but perhaps a key to these two characters as well. I realized, I don't know if musicologists would agree with me, by the way, but this is my own explanation, that if Bach wrote a cheerful aria about Judas having betrayed Christ and being in such despair, it's because we're not meant to identify with Judas. He didn't want his congregation to identify with Judas, so there's this sense of distancing from him. And instead, we have just the evocation of the sound of the coins bouncing. And we have a joyful renunciation of materialism by everybody in the congregation. And that's why the aria is cheerful. Give me my Jesus back. I want my spiritual health. I don't want money. I don't want coins. So that distancing, when everything else in St. Matthew seems to be so right in there, you know, with the emotions that the characters are experiencing, is what causes the guard, Rudy, to feel rejected and abandoned by Bach. You know, Bach, who can give such spiritual solace, does not give solace to the Judases of this world.
The character of Rudy is, in a way, also a doppelganger of Keller,
yes,
who's not a musician and has to deal with being a Nazi soldier, which he clearly doesn't want to be.
Right.
Is that particular section of St. Matthew's Passion available as a violin solo? I mean, could people go out and listen to it?
Well, it wouldn't work just as a violin
piece.
I remember the number. You know, any oratorio has many, many movements.
Sure.
And I still have a photocopy of this from when I played it. It's number 51 in the St. Matthew Passion. Whether that means that on a recording of St. Matthew Passion it would be on the 51st track, I'm not sure. But I'll tell you something funny that happened in the rehearsals of it with this choral organization, Musica Sacra, in New York, which still exists. The conductor, Dick Westenberg, paid me a nice compliment. He said, oh, you're the Mario Andretti of the violin. But that's an illustration of what kind of aria this is. It's not a deeply felt, lyrical, soulful aria. It's a kind of racy aria. And it does seem incongruous when moments before you have this member of the congregation asking for forgiveness, and not long after, no, perhaps it's also before, there's a recitative in which the evangelist, who's supposed to be St. Matthew, sung by a tenor, is talking about how Peter felt when the cock crowed and he realized for the third time that night he had denied Christ. And the music becomes very chromatic and tortuous at that moment. You sense the torment that Peter is feeling. But Peter has not committed a sin of the magnitude that Judas has committed.
You're listening to an interview with Eugene Drucker, whose novel is The Savior. Eugene Drucker plays violin with the Emerson String Quartet. There's a group of pieces that he plays inside the novel. There's a piece by Paul Hindemith, a piece by Eugene Isaïe.
Yeah, a Belgian violinist.
And also the Chaconne from Bach's Partita in D minor. Mm-hmm. Why did you select those particular pieces?
The repertoire for unaccompanied violin is not that big. There are six sonatas and partitas of Bach. The Chaconne, being the final movement of the D minor partita, is the single most famous movement out of that whole canon of works for unaccompanied violin. Well, there are some other Baroque works by a composer named Heinrich Bieber. That's played mostly by Baroque music specialists. In the standard violin repertoire, especially going back now to the 1930s and 40s, what a violinist would have played would have been those Bach works, Paganini caprices, maybe the Isaïe sonatas. Isaïe wrote six sonatas that are clearly based on and inspired by the six works of Bach. And then there were two solo sonatas by Paul Hindemith. And Hindemith is important in this story because his music was condemned by the Nazis as degenerate. It was dissonant, atonal, and completely devoid of sentimentality. It stood for everything that the Nazis didn't like. So the fact that Keller is interested in Hindemith, and then, as it turns out, the commandant of the camp asks him probingly, do you have any Hindemith? Well, that's something rather subversive. The other great piece for unaccompanied violin, which I have played a lot in my life, is Bartok Solo Sonata. However, that was written in the United States in 1944, so I couldn't include it in this story because it wouldn't have worked historically. It would have been an anachronism.
Let's talk a little, Eugene Drucker, about your career. When your father's a well-known violinist, how much pressure was it on you to even pick up the violin or to be a musician?
Looking back on it now, I'm often surprised that my father waited till I was 8 years old to start me on the violin. But we have to remember that in the 1950s, musicians, unless they were on the top tier of soloists or a few chamber music groups, did not have a really easy life. My father played in the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra for many years, and I hardly saw him. There were seven performances a week, as there are now, except now the contract, and it's been this way for many years, is that you play four performances out of those seven every week. Well, when my father was working in the 50s and first half of the 1960s, he played every performance, and he would get one performance off every 3 weeks. And then there were rehearsals on top of that. So he was away quite a lot of the time. It was not an easy life for musicians, and I think the general consensus among orchestra musicians was, don't start your kids on musical instruments. It's a dead end. Let them find a useful profession. Let them become lawyers, doctors, or anything other than being a musician. So somehow when I did start at the age of 8, it became apparent within a few months that I had some talent for it. And at that point, my father became very interested in my development. He was really involved. He practiced with me almost every day when he was in New York, when he wasn't on tour with the Met, and made sure that I had a good teacher in the neighborhood who happened to be a colleague of his, not at the Met, but in an orchestra in a summer festival in Chautauqua in southwestern New York State, where we went every summer. If she hadn't been in the neighborhood that first spring when he went on tour after I'd been playing for 4 months, I might not have continued with the violin, because you know how tenuous it is when a kid has been playing for a few months.
Sure.
And then the stimulus is gone all of a sudden, then the kid will not want to continue. So he made sure that I was well taken care of when he wasn't there violinistically, and he monitored my progress very closely. He made sure that I eventually went to a master teacher, Oskar Shumsky, when I was 13 or so. He followed every step of my career with great interest. And yes, there was a sense of pressure. There was a time when I was 12 or 13 that suddenly I was unsure whether I wanted to continue. No, I knew I wanted to continue, but I was unsure whether I would become a professional violinist. I didn't like the feeling of being on a career track predetermined at such an early age. And I remember my father was clearly disappointed about it. Anyway, I got over that momentary distraction. But when I was finished with high school, I had skipped a couple of grades, so I graduated high school at age 16. And in my senior year, it seemed like it would be kind of a waste for me to go only to a conservatory without getting some kind of academic education as well. So I applied to Columbia and Princeton, which both accepted me, and I went to Columbia.
And you majored in English?
Yes.
At that point, you were still involved with the violin as well?
Very involved with the violin. But the way it worked out, I had to take 5 years at Columbia in order to accumulate enough credits to graduate. And the third of those years, I actually wasn't going to Juilliard. I needed to beef up my course load at Columbia so that I could get within sight of the end. The way it worked out was that the first couple of years, maybe I was more involved with Columbia and with these big blockbuster courses that you have to take there, like contemporary civilization and humanities. And in the last few years, I was more involved at Juilliard. By that time, I had become concertmaster of the Juilliard Orchestra, and I was giving a greater priority to my musical activities.
That was also in a period when rock and roll was exploding, the late 60s, early 70s.
Yes.
And at that particular time, were you listening to pop music at all?
Not that much. It was a standing joke between my wife and myself in the early years of our relationship, you know, maybe 7 or 8 years later. She said, what planet did you grow up on? You were not familiar with all this stuff. And I said, well, I guess it was my own planet. But there was one period of a few months where I was listening to soul music. The reason was that in my freshman composition course in English in Columbia, the teacher was fascinated with soul music. So each week we had to listen and write a small paper about people like B.B. King, Otis Redding, Wilson Pickett, Aretha Franklin, James Brown. So that's how I became familiar with some of those people and their music.
Do you think there's anything you can draw from the way pop music is, or the way that these singers were in your own work? Or do you think that classical music is so separate from contemporary that there's nothing there for you?
Great musicians can always offer something for other musicians to learn from. And especially in jazz, there's this art of improvisation, which used to exist within classical music and has largely been lost. You know that Bach was a great improviser. Beethoven was an improviser who I think once even had a contest with some other famous pianist who was supposed to have also been a great improviser. Beethoven, of course, blew him out the door with his abilities to improvise. And even a part of an instrumental concerto for piano, violin, cello called the cadenza was improvised in those days. A cadenza is when all of the main work of the first movement of the concerto, of developing the material, is basically over, and you're near the end of the movement, and then there's an opportunity for the soloist to improvise on the themes of the concerto. What soloists do nowadays is either to write their own cadenzas or more frequently to use cadenzas by some great violinists, in the case of violin concertos, by Joseph Joachim or Fritz Kreisler. We use their cadenzas to the Beethoven, Brahms, Mozart violin concertos. You try to play them in such a way that they sound more improvisatory than the rest of the piece. But the actual art of making something up on the spot is something that we classical musicians have sadly lost. So that's something that you can learn from listening to great jazz players, not necessarily how to do it, but to hear that kind of spontaneity and somehow to try to simulate the spontaneity in your interpretation of notes that are already written down.
Well, now we're moving afield, but have you ever tried to improvise during those segments?
Well, I had a friend who was a jazz musician who once invited me to stand up with him at a late-night gig he was doing. Fortunately, there were only about two or three people in the audience at that point. So I didn't feel very confident in my ability to do it because I wasn't familiar enough with the harmonic progressions. But in the book, at one point, I have Keller start to improvise when things get really right. Wild between him and the audience, and he doesn't know what to do anymore. At this point, the audience, they're out of their seats. They're walking around the room. Finally, their feelings, which had been tamped down for so long because there was no outlet for them to express these feelings safely, finally they're starting to come out in a somewhat surrealistic scene. I don't meant it to be taken literally that I think this could actually have happened within 2 or 3 days.
You have not actually tried to improvise classical music.
No, the most improvisatory thing you do is in what we call rubato in classical music is when you stretch the rhythm. There are more or less creative ways of playing music as an interpreter. You're not really creating the work from scratch, but you can play with great imagination.
Have you ever tried composing?
Well, actually, right now, I almost hesitate to say it because I'm not completely sure this will come to fruition, but it better because it's already programmed for something next spring. I have been trying to set a group of Shakespeare sonnets for baritone and string quartet, and a young protege quartet of ours is scheduled to play it in Stony Brook, where we teach, and also in New York. What I'm trying to do in that set is to take the rhythm of the verses, as I imagine the poetry being recited, and use that as my inspiration for the rhythms of the music. And also the contour of the spoken voice, try to use that as the pitch contour. So it's not singing the way we normally think of it, where people sometimes prolong a syllable or do a melisma on a single syllable. That's not what I'm trying to do here. I'm trying to hew as closely as possible to the way I imagine the verse being recited. I love Shakespeare. I've always loved his plays and the sonnets as well. So sometimes I'm not that confident in my rhythmic imagination when I'm writing just straight instrumental music. But if you're trying to set iambic pentameter with all the different shades of meaning that Shakespeare has in there, then you're forced to write with a lot of asymmetrical rhythms, and that keeps you creative.
Eugene Drucker, in the New York Times, you were asked not long ago about what's happened to classical music today, and you said that the decline began right after World War II. That may or may not be true. I know that with LPs in the 50s and 60s, a lot of people were buying classical music. It seems to have fallen off the map, I would think, just in the past 20 years.
Yeah, I think you're right that the decline is much steeper in the last 20 or 30 years. What I was referring to specifically in that comment in the Times was that I can think back to a number of movies, Hollywood movies, that are not really about classical music, but in which there's some reference to classical music in the background of the story that forms a kind of cultural awareness that these people had. It manifests that people were aware of certain performers, certain pieces of music that nowadays analogous people in movies, mystery movies, for example, just wouldn't know about. The question was, has classical music declined as a result of the Holocaust? And my answer was basically no. I don't think it's because of the Holocaust. I think if classical music has declined in people's awareness, it's for many other reasons. It's hard to do a complete analysis of it, but I do think if you look back in some movies, I'm going to give you some specific examples, it just shows that people didn't think that classical music was something alien. Like in Double Indemnity with Fred McMurray, he goes for a walk behind the Hollywood Hills, near the Hollywood Bowl, I think, and you hear Schubert's Unfinished Symphony being played at a very key moment in the movie. They just wouldn't do that nowadays in a movie unless it had something to do with classical music, unless the theme of the movie had to do with classical music. And in A Lost Weekend with Ray Milland and Jane Wyman, at the beginning of the film when he just wants to indulge in his obsession with alcohol the whole weekend, his girlfriend comes in and says, I have 2 tickets to Carnegie Hall to hear Barbaroli conducting Brahms' Second Symphony. You know, these are young urban professionals. If there were a movie being made about somebody with an alcohol or drug problem nowadays, the girlfriend wouldn't be coming in saying, I've got tickets to hear Brahms' Second Symphony. You know, it would be something else.
Well, how much do you think the idea of multiculturalism has affected classical music, that classical music was written by, quote, dead white men?
I think that multiculturalism is a great thing, so that, you know, our whole focus should not be Eurocentric and realize that a lot of important music was being produced in so many other cultures. And even within our tradition, you have a composer like Bartok, who is one of the greatest ethnomusicologists of all time, went all over the Balkans and Asia Minor and even to Egypt, I think, other North African countries, collecting thousands of examples of peasant song. And he knew this stuff was dying out unless he somehow made an attempt to catalog it. And then later it informed the way he wrote classical music. He managed to put this folk music into the framework of large-scale structure using techniques that were only available to classical musicians in order to elaborate the material and develop it in ways that Western music had evolved over the centuries. So multiculturalism, I view, is a good thing. But the need to prove the relevance of classical music, or Shakespeare for that matter, is something that I don't feel so great about. The need to prove to people that the composers who created this music had emotions and that the music is expressing the emotions and that it's not fusty and irrelevant, that's unfortunate, you know, that we have to prove our relevance all the time to culture nowadays, but unfortunately we're in that position. So when there are ways of doing it that don't cheapen the culture that we're trying to keep alive, that's good. I know of one theater company in New York called Theater for a New Audience, which has a Shakespeare play every season. In addition to having this play off-Broadway, they will go into the inner-city schools and bring Shakespeare to kids who might not have had a chance to experience it otherwise, and I think that's a great service that they're performing. And analogous things are being done with classical music.
Does the Emerson Quartet ever go off into schools and do that then?
Sometimes. We used to do it more than we do now. We don't have quite as much time as we used to. But, yes, it's the kind of thing that concerns us.
And the sale of CDs and what's going on the Internet also affects classical music. It used to be that RCA Red Label was the number one label around, and now, you know, these tiny labels are putting out various classical music, and it's not really getting distributed.
The fact that there are tiny labels is not all a negative thing, because I think that might serve to keep the industry alive to some extent, you know, and make it more responsive to somebody's needs. We've been very fortunate that since 1987 we've had an exclusive contract with Deutsche Grammophon, which is another one of the really heavy hitters in the classical field. Now, Deutsche Grammophon, which is now part of Universal Classics, has been trying to be creative in keeping in touch with the times, the various different forms of media, the way that the music can be distributed. So they have an agreement with iTunes. I would say the last 3 or 4 years, all of our releases have come out in conjunction with iTunes, and we even record a special bonus track that is only available on iTunes. It's not on the CD, because this is one of the ways that people get music nowadays.
Eugene Drucker, do you think that the change in philosophy in America, the idea that money is all, and if it's not making money, it's worthless, and therefore there's no money going to orchestras from the government, do you think all this has affected classical music?
Certainly materialism doesn't help the artistic environment. The way the arts have operated in this country, as opposed to many Western European countries, is that there hasn't been significant government support for the arts. I mean, there's been something, and then in the last 12 or 15 years, it's become increasingly political, charged with all sorts of religious and cultural questions of whether there should be such a thing as a national endowment for the arts, for example. But most of the source of funding for big orchestras and other arts organizations comes from corporate sponsors. Sometimes the corporate sponsors are enlightened. I mean, they might have a department that is well informed about what you're trying to do in an arts organization, and they are generous, whatever their motivation may be. You know, of course, they always want to advertise their products, too. If they're not trying to control too closely what the arts organization is presenting, then I think it can be a positive thing.
Have you ever felt controlled at all? I mean, in your work or not at all?
No, well, we're a small organization, 4 people, you know, and we are pretty autonomous. We're able to make our own decisions. Sometimes, of course, we're asked to play specific repertoire. Those decisions for us about what we play are almost never fraught with political or materialistic implications. It's simply a question of what we have time to do and whether it's the thing that we want to focus on in a particular season.
Eugene Drucker, I guess that with all of your concerts coming up and working on this Shakespeare piece, there's not much time to write another novel, huh?
Well, I would love to write another novel now that I've had the opportunity to get published, and in my spare time I keep thinking about what that might be. I can't make any predictions yet, but I do intend to try.
You've been listening to an interview with Eugene Drucker, whose novel is The Savior. You have a new CD out?
The most recent release of the Emerson Quartet is a two-CD Brahms set of the three string quartets and the piano quintet with the great pianist Leon Fleischer.
I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.